Yoga in all its forms has been a support for me in my life, through all the highs and lows. It's opened my mind and my heart in ways I never knew were possible. It has been a teacher, a taskmaster, and a friend. This podcast is an offering. I wish to share the teachings of yoga with you as a tool to help navigate life. Namaste, and welcome. Welcome. I'm so happy you're here. So this is a part two episode because in the previous episode, we began discussing Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And I shared with you that we have a book club that's been going on for many, many, many years. And we have all of our meetings via Zoom. And this was our most recent selection. And I also offered that if anyone is interested in joining our book club, that they can contact me through the website, omtarayoga.com, omtarayoga.com. So we were speaking about Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And if you didn't listen to the previous episode, part one, you might want to go back and give that a listen before continuing on with us in this episode. But a little overview, this book was written by Viktor Frankl, who was a doctor of psychiatry. And he spent a portion of his life in a concentration camp as a prisoner during World War II. His time there was spent in part observing human nature in captivity, and how it behaves and the different characteristics that are revealed. And in doing so, he really came up with an amazing, I don't know, manuscript or manifesto on how to discover one's purpose in life. And we left off pretty much talking about happiness and the pursuit of happiness. And he talks about how happiness is not something that should be pursued, but rather ensued. So that when we are continually chasing after happiness as if this thing or this job or this person or this relationship is going to bring us happiness, we really exhaust ourselves as well as distract ourselves from the real questions that life is asking us. And life is asking us, what do you love? Who do you love? And in those desires, the answers to those desires, you will find your purpose. You will find what you uniquely are here to offer. Your reason for being, because it's not one big question for the masses. What is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of life? Why are we here? It's an individual question. It's a deep personal inner reflection. It's not a one-size-fits-all question or answer. So it also, in this book, he talks about how suffering is vital to us discovering our meaning, because it is through our suffering in life that we evolve and grow. You know, it's like that image of a broken bone, right? When a broken bone heals, it knits itself together, and it is said that it is stronger after it's healed than before the break. So are we. We are stronger after we have healed, after we have gone through the different fires of our life. We are absolutely knitted more strongly together. And so it stands to reason that our suffering is, listen, nobody wants to suffer. You know, we don't walk around going, bring it. Although there have been times in my life when I have done that. And it sounds silly to me now because I've gone through some big suffering in my life and in different forms. But I wasn't trying to be, you know, pretentious or obnoxious by saying, bring it on. It's just that I know what happens because I've been through it numerous times. That after the suffering, if I, as Dostoevsky informs us, you know, we want to be worthy of our suffering. So if I behave in a way that makes me realize that my suffering is happening for some reason. You know, I don't say everything happens for a reason. I say that everything happens for our liberation. And so when I realized that this suffering has to be happening for my liberation, I don't even necessarily know what I'm supposed to be liberated from, but I know as soon as I feel up to it, I got to get to work on whatever it is this suffering is showing up for, to teach me, to show me. And so when he talks about this happiness, he talks about it not being something that you're running after. No one else can give you directions to your own happiness. No one else can show you the way to your meaning. So we can read a book called Man's Search for Meaning that was written decades ago, but I promise you this isn't a book that has a subtitle of 21 Days to the Perfect You, because that is not in any book. There is no book, and there is no podcast, and there is no self-help group or whatever that is going to give you specific answers for you. But what they are is they're lighthouses. Okay, they're lampposts along the way. They're saying, I've been where you are or somewhere very similar. Try this. And maybe it'll work for you. And if not, you'll know what doesn't work for you. And then you can try something else from somewhere else. But there isn't a book or a podcast or all the things I mentioned that is going to give you, you know, the specific steps to take. And this book isn't doing that either. It isn't saying, do this and you'll know the meaning of life. It's talking about man's search for meaning. It doesn't say man's search for meaning and I got all the answers by Viktor Frankl. He's saying, here's what the search for meaning is all about. And one of the things that he highlights is, well, in my words, is happiness is an intrinsic part of our nature. And we are really spending our lives trying to ensue that happiness. In other words, we are hopefully making choices that will have happiness as an afterward. Like that happiness is the byproduct of the choices that we have made. It won't always be, but that's, like I said before, then we know don't make that choice because it didn't bring me happiness. Try this one. But the happiness is already there. It's like we're trying to reunite with it. It's not something you're going to find outside of yourself. And I promise you, it is rarely in another relationship. If you don't have happiness within yourself, how can it stand to reason that you're going to find happiness with or in someone else? It doesn't. You might combine your happiness. That's cool. But you need to know your own happiness and what makes you happy first. Okay, so it's not a book on happiness. But happiness is what ensues when you discover your meaning to life, your meaning. And your meaning to life, your purpose for being here, is revealed to you when you are able to be in communion with your passion, what you desire, who you love, what you love. He talks about suffering and he says, suffering may well be a human achievement, especially if the suffering grows out of existential frustration. So he says, I would strictly deny that one search for a meaning to his existence or even his doubt of it in every case is derived from or results in any disease. A man's concern, even his despair over the worthwhileness of life, is an existential distress. It may well be that interpreting the first in terms of the latter motivates a doctor to bury his patient's existential despair under a heap of tranquilizing drugs, which we know happens and has happened for a long time, where we're numbed to our desires very often, because very often we're going to the wrong places to get directions to what only we can take ourselves to or show ourselves. And he, again, just to remind you, if you didn't listen to the previous episode, part one of this man's search for meaning discussion, I'm pretty much going along the book and I've got 100 post-it notes on different pages and a whole bunch of things underlined. So I'm just lifting from the things that I underlined and kind of riffing on that. And he talks about here the existential vacuum manifests itself mainly in a state of boredom. Now he, and this is part two of this book, there's two parts. First part takes place in the camps, and the second part is him discussing logotherapy. It's either logotherapy or logotherapy. I don't know. Maybe somebody out there knows. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing it. But he's basically breaking it down. And this is a discussion on the existential vacuum. And he says the existential vacuum manifests itself mainly in a state of boredom. Now we can understand Schopenhauer when he said that mankind was apparently doomed to vacillate eternally between two extremes of distress and boredom. I don't know, this probably doesn't apply, but when my kids were little and they'd say, I'm bored, you know, when they were very little, they weren't coming to me when they were 13, but when they were very little, I'm bored. And I would say, well, I'm sure quite annoyingly to my children, I would say to them, boredom breeds creativity. If you're bored, I just had this feeling that you were going to then search out something to lift your boredom or to assuage your boredom. So boredom breeds creativity. So he goes on, he says, in actual fact, boredom is now causing and certainly bringing to psychiatrists more problems to solve than distress. And these problems are growing increasingly crucial for progressive automation will probably lead to an enormous increase in the leisure hours available to the average worker. The pity of it is that many of these will not know what to do with all their newly acquired free time. Now, not everybody, right? But when we talk about the computer age and we talk about this, you know, ease of access and this streaming of movies and TV shows, we have a lot more free time because of technology. And how are we spending that time is what he's, and this book was, you know, written back in the 50s, although I think this section is on a talk he gave in 84. So he's really just talking about, you know, he's not even talking about what we have available to us as distraction, as well as what we have available to us to free up our time. He says, let us consider, for instance, Sunday neuroses, that kind of depression that afflicts people who become aware of the lack of content in their lives when the rush of the busy week is over and the void within themselves becomes manifest. You know, and then I think of the flip side to that, people that are really living their private lives, their personal lives outside of work. How shall I put this? They hate their jobs, and so Sunday gives them like a pit in their stomach because they're not in a vocation that fulfills them or brings them meaning or makes them feel like they have purpose. Now, we've talked about this in the past in different forms in the episodes, but what I say to that is many people have to keep a roof over their head and they have to pay their taxes, their mortgage, their rent. They've got to put food on the table, gas in the tank. So a lot of people are working a lot of jobs that are not their passion. I get it. But you need to be able to almost disassociate from that, which is not easy. It's like your job makes you suffer. So now, are you worthy of that suffering? How are you spending your free time? And are you making sure you have free time? Because today with technology, a lot, and the phones, you know, and the beepers and the fax machines, you know, like that guy from Wanderlust, you know, now with all this technology, do you really get a break? Or is your job always in your face? So are you able to create boundaries, if you will, parameters around the job that's not your passion in order to, in the hours that you have not on the job, you are fulfilling a sense of worth, a sense of self. That's and is happiness ensuing from that? So not everybody goes to work all week and then when they have the weekend off, they're lost. Many people are because their job numbs them. It's just a job and they get so overly involved in, you know, just working at their job. It's not their passion. And then when everything gets quiet and they have time off to themselves, they don't know who they are. They don't know what they love. And that is what he's talking about, the Sunday neurosis and this existential vacuum or this existential frustration that occurs. And he says also that the meaning of life differs from man to man, from day to day, and from hour to hour. What matters, therefore, is not the meaning of life in general, but rather the specific meaning of a person's life at a given moment. So that's what I was alluding to earlier. It's not one big question and there's one big answer for everybody. Here's the meaning of life. And it's also not going to be one answer for you or me for the rest of our lives. But it's how we find meaning in the day to day, in the hour to hour. And when we're suffering and when we feel devoid of meaning or when we feel disconnected from the purpose of our life and from our higher spiritual things and from our essence, enter beauty, enter art, enter nature. That's when we need that to remind ourselves of the whole of this human existence and how freaking amazing it is to just be here. Remember, it's a miracle that you're here. I mean, we forget that. But there was like, I don't know, an egg and a sperm, an egg and lots of sperms. I don't know the whole thing. But you know what it takes for that to happen and for that situation to then form into a human, and then for that human to be birthed, and then for that human to survive and thrive? You're a miracle. You're a miracle. Wake up every day and look in the mirror and go, hey, beautiful, you're a miracle. And maybe you'll start living your life in that truth, because that's the truth. And from there, you'll find what you love and who you love and what you desire and what your passion is. And from there, you'll find your meaning. And then happiness ensues. So he has this one line that I got to tell you, we had to chew over a couple of times in our book club group when we met. But I think I might have an understanding, at least my own interpretation of it. And the line is this: live as if you were living already for the second time, and as if you had acted the first time as wrongly as you are about to act now. He says, it seems to me that there's nothing which would stimulate a man's sense of responsibleness more than this maxim, which invites him to imagine first that the present is past, and second, that the past may yet be changed and amended. I kind of like that, because so often we go through our lives repeating things. But what if we were to pause? What if we were to slow the roll a bit? What if we were to stop moving so blindly and erratically through our life and making these mistakes over and over again? But what if we were to stop and go, hey, let me just for a minute here pretend I've been here before, because you probably have. But pretend I've been here before. Pretend I'm living this as a second life. And I don't want to act as wrongly as I did the first time. Well, that means that we get to reflect on our past. And then our past reveals to us amendments that we can make, things that we can do differently so that we grow. That's how we evolve. We don't evolve by making the same mistakes over and over and over and over and over again. We have to stop and we have to reflect on what we're doing and why we're doing it and what can we change. And when we do that, we're able to literally change the story of the past, because if we look at the yoga term samskara, which is where we get the word scar from, it's these grooves and impressions that we're making in our brain, in our mind, in our narrative. Well, we get to amend those when we go, oh, I'm meditating and I'm taking my life a little slower. I'm reflecting, I'm journaling, I'm doing all the things that I hear to try. And in doing that, I have now created the habit to be able to recognize. I have heightened my senses of awareness to be able to recognize that this is a very similar situation to something that happened in my past. And it didn't go well. So I'm going to choose in the now an amended version of how I'll act given the lessons I've learned from the past. You see, that changes the past in a big way. And it's important to recognize that, you know, the past isn't something that, listen, we don't want to chew on it forever. There's nothing good there. But what we want to realize is that we have a lot to learn from it. And when we amend it, we learn about our own resilience and strength, and we move forward into the true version of our future self. Like we are doing that stringing the pearl thing that we've talked about for the version of our future self that we desire and that we know we already are. We just have to string some pearls to get there. So he goes on and he says, in some way, suffering ceases to be suffering at the moment it finds a meaning, such as the meaning of sacrifice. So he goes on and he discusses a patient of his who was in despair over grief of losing his wife. His wife died, and he was able, with the help of Dr. Frankl, to be able to change his attitude toward the unalterable fate. So you can't bring the wife back. But he said that basically he was able to say, well, let me ask you, you know, if you had died first and your wife would have survived you, you know, what would have happened? And the guy said, oh, for her, this would have been terrible, how she would have suffered. So then I replied, you see, such a suffering has been spared her, and it was you who have spared her this suffering, to be sure at the price that now you have to survive and mourn her. So he's basically saying, well, what I hear him saying is, A Course in Miracles defines a miracle as a shift in perception. So he's basically offering a different perspective for this guy to look at his unalterable state. His wife died. He's in terrible mourning. He's grieving his wife. And he says, well, let me ask you a question. What do you think? What is your notion of if she had survived you? Oh, that would have been terrible. He said, so your sacrifice was that you are the survivor and you have to stay here and be in this grief. Not so that he gets stuck in the grief, but so that it feels like, he says, in some way, suffering ceases to be suffering at the moment it finds a meaning, such as the meaning of a sacrifice. And he, in no small way, goes on to talk about in this book the very power of service. How we know that to serve another is to assist ourselves in being able to step out of our own way. Very often we get stuck in our story. We get stuck in our circumstance. Absolutely true. And one of the most tried and true ways to begin to lighten the burden of our own circumstance or suffering is to serve another. And of course, His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, teaches of this, you know, always, that to serve another is in truth a selfish act. And I'm paraphrasing here, His Holiness, by all means, but that when you serve another, it's that boomerang effect. So very often we'll find people that have retired from work, which I like to call reimagination. So you're reimagining a new life for yourself when you leave one job at a certain time in life. And you're able to, you know, you can be in a bit of a limbo, right? And you're not really sure what your purpose is now or what you're going to do next. But we all need a purpose. We all need a meaning. And so best case scenario is to volunteer, to go out and serve the youth, volunteer at a library. There's a million ways, you know, dog rescues, animal rescues, to serve, so that immediately gives your life meaning. It to be in service. He says, man does not simply exist, but always decides what his existence will be, what he will become in the next moment. Man is capable of changing the world for the better if possible, and of changing himself for the better if necessary. There's so much in this book. I highly recommend it. I could go on and on and on and on. He talks about the case for a tragic optimism, and he goes into the whole idea of this pursuit of happiness even deeper in that section, and he goes on. But I want to finish with two things. One, he says, for the world is in a bad state. This is 1984, so can you imagine in 2024? For the world is in a bad state, but everything will become still worse unless each of us does his best. So let us be alert in a twofold sense. Since Auschwitz, we know what man is capable of. And since Hiroshima, we know what is at stake. I thank you so much for indulging me, assuming someone's listening, to my discussion on Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. It's a book I've had on a couple of shelves in my life for a long time. I myself did not go to college, so I missed it being required reading in the freshman year, but I'm pretty certain I wouldn't have had a clue what they were talking about when I was 18. So I'm really happy at 59 that this book has found me. And of course, I'm always blessed to be able to offer my perception on things and hope that in some way it brightens or lightens your day. Hands together at the heart center. May all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings be healthy and strong. May all beings be safe and protected. May all beings live with ease. Namaste.